Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Fine. Where are you?
I'm in Aspen at the Aspen Ideas Festival, Mickey. You know why I'm here?
Because you're brilliant. I read that.
I have ideas.
I read that you were brilliant in the New York Times Book Review. I couldn't read the review. All I saw was this word brilliant glowing in the center of the page.
Yeah, well, that's where the blurb that we're using stops, too.
Congratulations.
Thank you. That was actually very lucky because the review apparently was very readable. The review itself made the most emailed list in the New York Times.
Hey, it's always luck.
It is. It is.
Brilliant it people is make their own luck. But
isn't that, how do you say that in Latin? That's a very old saying.
I'm so happy you're at the Aspen Ideas Institute, Bob, because I've been getting these Twitters from other people who are in Aspen about what a great time they're having and how brilliant everybody is. And if only I were there, I would be enjoying it as much as you are. And I just so appreciate these emails about what a wonderful time you and Kurt Anderson are having that I'm not having.
Haven't run into Kurt.
It really brightens up my day. Only the Atlantic would think that readers enjoy having their noses pressed against the glass and learning about an event in which they cannot participate.
Actually, it seems quite interactive. I just got here. I haven't done anything significant yet, but you may be surprised to hear that the badges, is there a badge, you know, the big, huge badges that people wear around their necks, are not very conspicuously status-oriented. So that, you know, at some places you go like Davos and it's like speakers have one color and people who paid thousands of dollars to see the speakers have another color. Badges look all alike. You have to get very close to someone to see whether it says speaker or not, and by then it's too late to ignore them. So that may surprise you. It's democratic in that regard.
That's a bad break for you, Bob, because you're a speaker, but I don't understand. What about the people who aren't invited at all? How is that democratic? It's like this party the Atlantic gave a couple of years ago where they had the guests on stage partying and the audience was allowed to sit in the bleachers and look at the invited guests partying. If they put it all online, which they could run a video of the whole thing online, then everybody could feel they were participating. But we are expected to be delighted by tweets saying, hey, that panel was great. Well, you know, I don't know.
You sound just a little bitter.
It's lucky I'm not bitter because if I was sensitive to this sort of slight, who knows what would happen.
Well, Mickey, at the risk of heightening your bitterness, I would just like to say I'm really enjoying my little 5-star hotel here. I'll give people a look at my luxurious 5-star hotel suite, okay? Just went down and had a nice steam bath in my 5-star hotel, Mickey. And in fact, Mickey, I think I'll adjust the lighting. I'm going to use the electronic control of the drapes to, let's see, I think I'll open the drapes by pressing a button, Mickey.
You're supposed to be roughing it in Aspen, even if you don't have a 5-star hotel. Yeah. You're in spectacular surroundings, idyllic surroundings I saw on the Atlantic's website.
You know the trouble with 5-star hotels, Mickey? You know the trouble with 5-star hotels?
Are you actually in a 5-star hotel, or are you putting me on?
No, they claim it is. I don't know. Maybe 4 or 5. It's the one where rock stars stay in when they're in Aspen.
Which is what?
The Little Nell. Little Nell.
Okay.
And in honor of them, I may trash the room. But you know the trouble with staying in a nice hotel is that you get hypercritical. Like, for example, what kind of person would complain about electronic drape controls? But you're about to hear a complaint. They're binary. They've got to be either completely open or completely closed. That gives you very little. You can either go with a Rembrandt look, which we've got right now on my face, or you can close them. Whoops, wrong button. Or you can close them all the way. But you can't. It's physically impossible to have these drapes half open, Mickey. Physically impossible. Can't do it. Can't do it manually. Can't do it electronically. Can't do it.
That's maddening, Bob. I mean, I know you would never be hypercritical unless it was justified.
Plus, the color of the M&Ms. The color of the M&Ms is driving me nuts. Actually, Harry Shearer is here. I haven't seen him. Speaking of that allusion to Spinal Tap.
Now I'm incredibly jealous. So Harry Shearer's there and I'm not?
Yeah, a couple of former secretaries of state and me.
That's, anyway, you're just, like, plunging me further into depression.
Yeah, I'll get zero FaceTime with those people, probably. Certainly the secretaries of state. But, you know, you hosted a book party for me at which there were famous personages.
There were, although the hottest woman in the world was not there, it turned out.
Oh, who would have thought that she would not be at my book party? That's really surprising.
She almost came. She was invited. She could have come.
You know, Mickey, I've only been at the Aspen Ideas Festival like a few hours, and I've only been down at the festival part itself for like 10 minutes, and I've already picked up an idea.
That's pretty great. I should say that explaining this hottest woman in the world comment, Maxim's number one hot woman in the world is this actress Olivia Wilde, who knows some people, who was on the show House, and your party was co-hosted by a writer for House, so she was invited, but she didn't show up.
No.
She hadn't read the New York Times Book Review. If she had read the Times Book Review, I'm sure she would have showed up.
Needless to say.
Okay, but anyway, go ahead. You had an idea.
I didn't have it. I mean, that's the thing about the festival, Mickey. They're everywhere. You don't have to have them. They're everywhere. They fall on you, okay? So I was having a conversation with a noted NPR radio personality, Brooke Gladstone, whom you know, I believe.
I know her well. I know her.
And I was talking about this Mark Sanford guy. You've heard of him, haven't you?
I have. Yeah.
And I was saying, this was not so much an idea as I thought a very nice turn of phrase. And I was saying, so apparently, according to this, have you read this, Mickey, that apparently he's now given, like, he's gone beyond the press conference and given, like, an ill-advised interview to AP or something?
Yes. So is his wife.
And he said stuff like, first of all, he said he disclosed some moment where, in thinking about this woman in Argentina, he said, you know, well, I was just happy to know that I had, you know, whatever happened for the rest of my life, I had found my soulmate, you know? Something like that?
Yes, and, he did say something like that.
He did say something like that. And I said to Brooke, you know, it seems like this is the kind of, like, if you're having trouble making up your mind between these two women, you should really work this out in private. And she said, he's living out loud. And I thought, that's a great phrase. And I asked her, you know, is that already becoming like an idiom or something? And she said, yeah, I think it's partway there. Had you heard that phrase used that way? Living out loud?
I hadn't. No, it's a good phrase.
It's a great phrase, and it's kind of what we do on Blogging Heads TV.
Exactly, exactly. Except we keep the real decadence is behind the scenes.
Not in my case. The whole story is as big.
I got the whole five-star, the electronic drapes, everything.
Everything, everything. I hold nothing back. So this could be our motto, Blogging Heads TV, living out loud.
That's a good one. That's a good
one.
It's not that bad. There was a famous... I think they're making a movie of this. The guy who was the entrepreneur behind Sudo.com had a project called Living in Public, where he put his entire life on the web 24/7. In the process, lost his girlfriend and his dignity, but nevertheless, he made internet history. And they're making a movie about it. Mark Sanford.
Mark Sanford? Go ahead.
I like the part where he said he was trying to fall back in love with his wife.
Yeah, that's got to make her feel good.
I thought that'd be a good country song, you know. I'm trying to fall back in love with my wife, but she makes it so hard. You know?
Yeah, but my heart just won't let me do it. You know, I mean, that guy. It's funny, you know, I am such a sucker. That first press conference, I did counterspin on the first press conference because everyone had lowered my expectations. They said he did a meltdown and everything. And I looked at it, and although I very much disliked this guy going in because of that ridiculous stimulus package grandstanding, I saw the thing and I thought, you know, I think he's trying to work through it. He's trying to be honest. And I believe the part where he said this was his only extramarital affair, which he seems to be taking back in this.
No, he didn't take it back, Bob. He said he crossed the line, but his line is dancing with another woman is crossing a line.
Was that clear in context?
Yes, I think so. Have you danced with another woman, Bob? If so, then you have crossed this
line.
Really?
I haven't even danced with my wife. I hate to dance. No, I have danced with... I danced with another woman at my 25th college anniversary. I mean, reunion.
Well, there you go. You went to a place where a married man is not supposed to go.
Yeah, that was 5 years ago.
Well, according to Mark Sanford, that's crossing a line. He claims to only have had sex with this one woman.
He's still claiming that, really?
Yes, but if this AP reporter must be incredibly persuasive, because not only has Sanford given a stupid interview, but the wife also gave a stupid interview that she shouldn't have given to the AP, where she sort of, said, various things that didn't make her seem, like, incredibly lovable. But,
like, what'd she say?
Oh, you would think a man who wants to see his children again would toe the line. that sort of thing.
Well, I don't know. I think she's got a right to say
Maureen
that. She's entitled to say a lot. I just thought she sounded bad when she said, maybe we can work it out. You know, this coming on the heels of him saying, I'm working on working it out, but the woman's just too hideous for me to stay married to you.
She said that again today because she's trying to do her part to stop him from having to resign. I was sort of wrong because, there's this imperative to write something about topic A. So when the Sanford thing happened, there was tremendous pressure from Slate to write something about it. And I wrote what I thought was a reasonable piece about how, gee, this is like the Filer Faster principle. You know, everything's happening all at once. The whole scandal came out at once, so it's all going to be over with more quickly. But then it wasn't all over with.
Mm-hmm.
Because he kept giving these stupid interviews.
So you were wrong.
So I was
wrong. Of course,
you said
9/11 was going to be over with in about, 10 days or something? Was that your prediction right after 9/11?
Like,
we'd forget about this thing right away?
I said it'd be off the front page by Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you didn't specify which year, which Thanksgiving.
Right? No, I did. But there actually was a front page where it wasn't on a couple months later. But in general, I was wrong because the implication was we'd forget about it quickly.
But I thought it was very big of you to fess up to that major...
Actually, I wrote this anniversary thing where I tried to fess up
right.
to my...
It's the 10th anniversary of Cast Files. I wish I had some birthday favors or something, but congratulations. Happy birthday.
I had to milk that out of you, man. I was like pulling teeth.
No, I brought
I
up...
Call
the,
you
I segued us into
you,
there.
I call you brilliant right off the bat, and I have to milk the 10th anniversary out of you. Okay.
No,
be like
I was
that.
Going there. I was saving it for the climax of the dialogue.
But anyway, they ran a cartoon of me on Slate that showed me having no hair on the top of my head, which, as viewers know, is completely unfair.
Yeah.
There are dozens of hairs up there. And anyway, I tried to confess to my sins, but I actually forgot a stupid thing, an additional stupid thing I said, which is I said... Oh, like last year I said, oh, this housing crisis, it's not going to be as bad as people say. So,
wow. With your 9/11 blunder. That's too bad.
I may have to put that one up, too.
But you did say don't invade Iraq, thanks to you-know-who.
That's correct.
Yeah.
You saved me from idiots. And it is easy. I went back. It is easy to forget how many people who are now perfectly respectable were for the war in Iraq.
In fact, it's not easy for me to forget.
In fact, I didn't have to take your advice. I could have been for the war in Iraq, and by now I'd be posing as an anti-war agitator. I mean, Fareed Zakaria.
Oh, yeah,
was,
I know. Everyone who supported it has forgotten. Were you going to mention that they supported it? Were you about to mention somebody?
Well, Fareed Zakaria is one.
The thing about him, though, was he was clearly supporting it against his better judgment at the time because he was saying, look, if Afghanistan is any precedent, we're going to screw this thing up because in Afghanistan, we're not investing the resources after the war to keep things calm and orderly, and we're going to do the same thing in Iraq, and you know, there was some truth to that. So he was his ideology counsels him against that war, and I think that's the way he felt. But I think the I don't know why, but I think peer group pressure was pretty strong, man. A lot. It was... I don't care to remember that episode in the history of the American establishment.
I actually think I agree with you. It was quite strong. Even Joe Klein, who, you know, was running around saying this is the biggest mistake foreign policy blunder in American history. In the event the week before the war and Meet the Press knuckled and supported the war.
But, you know, I've got to say,
that Joe Klein isn't a beacon of stability in all these things.
Joe Klein's brilliant.
Where does it say he's brilliant? I read that you were brilliant, but I didn't read that Joe
Klein. I just said he's brilliant. You care to gainsay that?
Are you serious?
Yeah, I am serious. I think he's brilliant.
Well, I think he wrote a great novel, and I think he's very, very good at what he does, and what he does I could not do. I would not say he's brilliant.
Would you care to elaborate?
Yeah, he goes into a situation he doesn't know anything about and comes up with a piece. I can't do that. He flies to Iran
and comes up
with a piece. It's not brilliant, but it's a certain talent that I don't have that he has. He has the life force.
He's also very well versed in some things.
He's very well versed and very well read. I agree with that. But he's flighty and he falls in and out of love and he's inconstant. He's not as excitable as Andrew Sullivan, but he's excitable.
And as long as I'm getting you in trouble by getting you to diss people on videotape, what do you think of Fareed?
I sort of like Fareed. Everybody loves his show, and what I've seen of it, it's been really good. He has smart people on, and they do inform you better than the average talk show. Aside from that, I have no particular views. I remember being hostile to the thesis of his book about democracy, which was Democracy, which I even forget the thesis, but it was...
Well, the main point of his book was that democracy is not necessarily a good thing. I mean, what was the title of the book? There was an adjective he applied to democracy.
This actually is a perfect segue to Iran.
Yeah, because I was reading his Iran piece in Newsweek and thinking he's actually very good. He says smart stuff. He knows his stuff. I was actually thinking he's arguably one of the few people who has a TV show and deserves to have one, you know?
I think he's brilliant.
Yeah.
But, his piece in Newsweek was very sensible. It basically said, this is the Iran situation isn't like the wall falling. We shouldn't expect there to be a revolution. Forces of nationalism and religion are militating against us. And Obama was right to not give Ahmadinejad what he wanted and appear to be meddling from the outside. In contrast to Fareed's good friend, Leon Wieseltier, who wrote a diarist in the New Republic, basically ripping Obama a new one for worrying too much about giving Ahmadinejad what he wanted. I do think Leon made one very good point, though.
What was that? Well, I think Leon's brilliant. What was this good point?
Leon's good point was that what is driving Obama is not just realism. It's not just that, you know, he knows we're going to have to deal with the powers that be in Iran and we want to stop them from having nuclear weapons. It's not just that he knows that the moral arc of history is on his side and that democracy will come to Iran eventually anyway. It is also that he has an aesthetic preference for not being the ugly American. Perhaps from his youth, he is trying not to be the sort of American that the people he lives with resented. And that's an extra realistic factor.
But
it's
that
not realism, it's idealism.
That instinct happens to coincide perfectly with our needs on the foreign policy front. I mean, our big problem on foreign policy under Bush was just too many kind of average people out in the world hating us, including, you know, large numbers of people in Muslim countries where if enough people hate you, then it's easy to recruit terrorists and so on. And Obama knows what it's like to be one of those people, and so his disaesthetic preference is perfect.
Well, what about Honduras? I mean, there he's clearly sided with the president.
Fascinating question. I have that question for Leon, okay? Now, we should review this piece by Leon Wieseltier, who, by the way, I think is brilliant. It was in the New Republic. And
why isn't he, if he's so brilliant, why isn't he at Aspen?
Why isn't he at, well, I didn't say he was that brilliant. I mean, there's brilliant Mickey.
Okay.
There's Leon Wieseltier brilliant, and then there's Harry Shearer brilliant.
Okay.
Now, so his piece was, you know, the neocon line on Obama and Iran, complaining that he didn't come out of the gate on behalf of the demonstrating masses. I don't know. And first of all, I have a little critique of the structure of his argument. I mean, you remember he says, so Obama had said, you know, you would think Leon would credit Obama with having said, look, the world is watching, having disapproved of the violence used to crack down the demonstrators and saying the world is watching. And there's some line in there about, well, when the world is watching, all the world does is watch or something. In other words, and then that was followed by something like pressing send is not a very muscular act of foreign policy or something. And the point was words alone, you know,
but
right?
Was,
that's the only
He was ridiculing all the Twitterers who thought they were helping the Iran revolution by changing their icons to green.
Okay,
I mean, he was ridiculing over-enthusiastic people who were saying, oh, the information revolution is going to bring down the government of Iran. Well, no. And he was also presumably calling for some action as opposed to words.
But that's my question, okay? Exactly. When he's dismissing Obama saying that thing that clearly gave the demonstrators some heart, at least. I'm sure they liked him, hearing him say, listen, the world is watching, okay? And Leon dismisses that. Well, what does Leon want? If he wants action, what is the action? I mean, all he ever actually asked for is denunciation, and yet he dismisses what denunciation Obama does issue. I think it's one of those columns where the context changed in midstream. He had planned to write this column before Obama had said anything, and then once Obama started saying the kinds of things he was going to recommend that Obama say, he had to, like, dismiss them. Because when you think about it, the column's not coherent. Although he really is brilliant.
Aren't there actions that we could take that surely the people who are condemning Obama wanted him to do more than just issue rhetoric?
Sure, but I'm saying if they are, let's hear them. I mean, if that's what Leon's saying, let's hear them. What does he want us to do?
Well, I assume you say, you know, we're not going to talk to these guys for 6 months, you know, and...
Look, there's economic sanctions, there's a world of things.
We're organizing economic sanctions, and, you know,
yeah.
we want the UN to come in and supervise a recount or something, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm just critiquing the inconsistency in this particular argument, but speaking of Honduras...
It's not inconsistent if he has some actions. The clear implication was he wanted action, not just talk. I mean, that was clear. Why was that inconsistent? It may be wrong, but it's not inconsistent.
Well, no. I think the only thing he explicitly complained about is Obama not talking in the way he wanted Obama to talk. And then in cases where Obama did that, he dismissed it. But
no,
maybe I'll read the column.
It opens with an anecdote about Clinton saying we have to free Bosnia without doing anything to free Bosnia. So it begins with an example of
okay.
somebody talking and not taking action. That's the point.
Okay, well, what action? Then tell us what action. Because the only thing that he complains about is Obama not denouncing the guy more fervently. What's the action? If you think you've got action we could take to change the regime in Iran, please let us know.
Well, that's the same with this much more virulent rant in the Jerusalem Post by this woman, Carolyn Glick, who excoriates Obama's realism. But it's not clear exactly what action she wants other than allying with Bibi Netanyahu and bombing Iran.
If that's what Leon likes,
I don't think that's what Leon likes, but I don't know what Leon likes. But you're right, he lets himself off the hook by not saying what he actually wants.
Okay, now here's my other question. On Honduras, where Obama came out firmly on the side of democracy, clearly and loudly, from the beginning, you would think, certainly the kind of old-school realist thing to do, they're accusing Obama of being too much of a realist, the neocons and Leon
This is a case where realism departs from his desire to be the unugly American. You said they were consonant. They're not consonant. Here he was not doing the realist thing, but he was pursuing his aesthetic desire not to be the ugly American by supporting Zelaya.
So you think that although Leon didn't cite Honduras, I think you're saying that Honduras is consistent with his thesis.
Yes.
His use of the word aesthetic.
It's not just realism. Does he use the word aesthetic? It's not just realism. It's a personal preference.
Okay. I have a reply to that, but first I'd like to know, Leon and in general, neocons, the people who are complaining about what Obama did in Iran, are they celebrating Obama for this thing in Honduras? I genuinely don't know, but you'd think if they're consistent, they would be doing that.
Well, it's a little bit, I think he did the right thing in Honduras, but it's a little muddy in that this guy who was elected president was in the process of doing various unconstitutional things, and when the Supreme Court of Honduras said you can't do it, he was going to go ahead and do it anyway. So what do you do? I guess what would happen in the United States if that happened? I guess he'd be impeached. He was behaving in a way that was not consistent with the rule of law and a democracy, even though he was elected. So there's a case on the other side
that is a wrinkle that has emerged. But my question is, I don't even think that justifies the coup or validates claims that it's not a coup.
But my question is,
in the first instance, when Obama first did this, where were the neocons? And maybe I'm wrong, and maybe they were celebrating him. I just would ask, if democracy is really what they're on the side of, did they? I don't know. Did they celebrate
the
Obama?
The first thing I saw was a Twitter from William Crystal saying you should read this article. And the article was by a guy named Noriega, who was trying to argue that Zelaya was not a Democrat. So they were trying to restore consistency to their argument.
By saying the president of Honduras had not been a Democrat?
Correct.
Very interesting. Because there's another theory as to why they wouldn't want the president of Honduras.
I understand that he was term limited, and he's trying to extend his term.
Yeah, but he wasn't doing it by mandate. He wanted to have a referendum that I think would have even been non-binding. But in any event, he wasn't declaring his right to it. I mean, that seems to me a very strained argument that Crystal was embracing, and perfectly consistent with my expectation that the neocons would, in this case, suddenly, when Obama does embrace democracy, suddenly find a reason not to applaud. Because, you know, this president I assume that by being in league with Hugo Chavez, they would think of him as vaguely in league with Ahmadinejad, with whom Chavez is vaguely in league himself, right?
Oh, I don't think it ties in with Ahmadinejad. I think it ties in with the general struggle against, you know, leftism and Castroism.
Okay. That's a relatively flattering interpretation, but they're still not being consistent, in my view.
But go ahead, tie it to Israel.
I was getting there, but you stopped me.
But there is another point where Leon is right, I thought, which is that I don't understand why Obama, you know, he couldn't do anything. Why can't he say, look, we're for democracy, we're for the Democrats in Iran, right from the start, make that clear, and then it's clear where the United States stands. Instead, he doesn't say anything for a while, and then he comes up with what looks like a press agent, I got to say something, and it seems inauthentic. It seems press agent.
You're talking about Iran now.
Iran, yes.
Yeah, I agree that the way it played out, it kind of seemed like that. I mean, they were too fast out of the gate commenting. You know, I mean, Biden certainly was too quick to say, "Oh, we'll do business with whoever is in charge at the end." I agree that all along the timing looked like he was playing catch up.
And here's do we really think that the reformers won the election? I mean, I'm not convinced at all. I would like to think that they would have won.
But. Yeah, now I heard somebody say that Ahmadinejad stole the election from himself. In other words, he would have won by a less comfortable margin, but they weren't content with that.
That's what Chris Dickey wrote in Newsweek. He said the State Department people at the highest levels of government think that he stole an election he would have won anyway.
Yeah.
But my impression is that people like Reza Aslan think he actually stole the election, period. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he just thinks they tried to steal an election, regardless of whether they would have won it anyway.
I think people like Flint Leverett, who know a lot about Iran, some of them have said, in agreement with him, that it's totally plausible that he would have won that election, and that Ahmadinejad would have won, and that the expectation that he would have lost was based on an overly hopeful reading of unrepresentative parts of Iran.
But there might have been a runoff, so...
There might well have been a runoff, and they may have feared that. And I don't know what the long-term thing is, how this plays out.
I thought the long-term was what Mike Murphy said in his Twitter, which is the young people don't like the mullahs, and there are a lot of young people, and the old people are dying off, so it's just a matter of time.
Well, that was under 140 characters, so that was good.
It's the arc of history, yeah. Bob.
It's the arc of history. I think most people are saying this is another nail in the coffin. But kind of, you know, between now and the funeral, there's a question of, like, whether they build a nuclear bomb and stuff like that.
But your whole book is about how, in agreement with Martin Luther King, the arc of history tends towards justice. So you should presume we agree with Mike Murphy on that and think, you know, eventually if they don't blow us up, the forces of democracy will win out in Iran, because that's the only way they can prosper and join the global economy. And as we know, religion is an epiphenomenon and the economy rules, so they'll change their religion if they have to.
Yeah, but the loophole in my argument has always been that we could blow up the world before the second coming. Can I make one point about before we leave Honduras entirely? Is that you could argue that, I mean, you're saying that the consistency between Obama's reluctance to get heavy-handed with the Iranian government and his getting heavy-handed against the coup plotters in Honduras is that he never wants to, what is it, he never wants to, what is it, what is the consistency you're claiming, that he never wants to look like the ugly American?
Yes.
I would argue that in both cases, the policy makes sense in an environment when you take into account how much in the current day and age public perceptions of America matter, grassroots perceptions of America matter. I think both of the policies are basically the right policies, and why can't it be that he's just taking that into account? And in a way, you could even call that a kind of a new kind of realism, right? I mean, traditional realism you would think of as having possibly sided with the coup plotters, cynically sided with the coup plotters because we didn't like the ideology of the president. But maybe the new realism that never mind. Go ahead.
You're saying that the new realism, you should side with the anti-Americans whether or not realistically the United States could do something to actually promote democracy. So in Iran, if there was something we could do to force a fair election, we shouldn't do it because the anti-Americans wouldn't like that?
I'm not saying that. I think if at any point they had thought that there was something that they could do to tilt the balance in Iran, they would have done it. And in fact, they did start doing things like that, including, like, ask the people at Twitter not to do some upgrade that would have taken Twitter offline for half an hour or something, right? So I think, you know, what's that?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I'm not saying that. It's just my original point, where you say it's a mere, or you say Leon says it's a mere aesthetic preference to care about what people think of America, and I'm saying no, it's a realistic and smart foreign policy.
We've ascertained that realism and the desire not to be the ugly American are not coincident. Look at Honduras, where they dictate different results. So you're saying it's a good thing to pursue this anti-ugly American stance, and I'm saying no, not where it differs with realism.
You're saying that what they did in Honduras was not realism.
Not really. Real realism would say, look, we're probably not going to get Zelaya back, you know, why support a quixotic attempt to restore the leader when the military has the power? Now, maybe that's a misreading of the situation.
Now, I agree that that's old-fashioned realism. I'm suggesting, though, that I'm suggesting this was a support of democracy not driven by a devotion to ideals per se, okay? I mean, realism is characterized partly by being an amoral foreign policy, right?
Right.
In the sense that although the ends, ultimately, you may justify it in terms of moral goals, it's not the short-term pursuit of moral ideals per se, like democracy, like human rights. That's what characterizes realism. And so you say, well, when he supports democracy, it's not realism. I'm saying in the modern world where perceptions of America matter so much, it may be that, if you ask, what is the, just push morality aside, what's the amorally correct, the amoral American self-interested thing to do? It may have been to support democracy in the case of Honduras. I think it probably was.
So
does that make sense?
I think so. I think you're sort of saying you embrace the right wing's attack on Obama, which is that he's not a realist. He actually just believes in supporting anti-Americans on leftists around the world. And you're saying, yes, that's a good thing for now.
Well, but if he understands it's a good thing for now, then he's just a new, more sophisticated kind of realist
who's adapted
to the new environment. I don't think it's just an instinct. I think he's smart enough
to do that
on purpose.
I'm not sure that he is. What he doesn't give me is the assurance that he is committed to the idea that we are Americans and ultimately we believe in democracy and we have our own interests down there, and if the world doesn't like it, that's tough luck. He gives no sense of having that much backbone. It wouldn't take much for him to give me that sense. And then generally,
I'd rather have him than
the alternative.
What's an example of that that you would like to see him do that he's not doing?
Well, on Iran, he could have said, we're Americans, we believe in democracy, that we think, ultimately this is the solution, not just for us, but for you guys too. Sorry, that's what we think. And we're outraged if you stole this election, and that's where we stand. And instead, he sort of said, the world is watching injustice. It was a little wishy-washier than that.
Yeah, but I think it was savvily wishy-washy. The Fareed analysis makes sense to me, and the analysis of a lot of people, that by not being George Bush, he has made it easier for the reformists, for elites to support the reform movement in Iran without being
accused. No, I basically agree. I just think it wouldn't have taken much to satisfy Fareed and do that, and yet reassure skeptics, including myself, that he's not just the product of his, upbringing in East Asia. that he has a little bit of George Bush in him. I don't want a lot. I just want a little.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say his pitch was perfect throughout.
Anyway,
do we know anything else about that, or what's that?
No, I know nothing else.
We don't. So we should now turn. You're going to deliver a lecture about healthcare now?
Well, no, I just had I had a couple of thoughts, and because the healthcare debate is going to be going all summer, and I had a couple of thoughts, and you could tell me if you think they're crazy or not. I was reading Ruth Marcus's piece. First, the good news on healthcare is, there's this big debate on will there be a public plan or not. Obviously, the Democrats are going to take a healthcare bill whether or not there's a public plan, because A, they would look like fools if they didn't pass something this time around. I mean, what good are Democrats if they can't pass a healthcare bill under these circumstances? And B, the process is being run by Obama, not by Hillary Clinton, who, stupidly brushed aside all attempts at compromise in going for the grand enchilada, the whole enchilada last time. He's not going to do that. So there will be a healthcare bill. So that's the good news, right?
This was kind of E.J. Dionne's point in the column he wrote, right? That Obama learned the lesson of Hillary. Don't etch anything in stone.
Well, E.J.'s point was that he should actually backtrack from that and also dictate a bit to the leaders of Congress who were in the process of unetching everything at some point Obama has to say, no, this is the way it is, and you have to get on board, which is obviously true. What my problem is trying to figure out whether there should be a public plan or not, and here's what I don't understand. We
should say, right, the public option is giving people the option of a plan that is what, exactly what federal government workers get? Is that it?
No.
Wrong. Okay, we should say that it's not that. That's what I meant. We should say that it's not that.
No, everybody gets, there will be some sort of health care exchange, which is similar to what federal workers have, whereas you'll get a smorgasbord of insurance options. Okay, you'll be required to have insurance, so you go to this exchange, and there'll be, Aetna will be offering some plan, the Fireman's Fund will be offering some plan, and the Bricklayers will be offering some plan, and, you know, Kaiser will be offering some plan, and those are all private insurers or private nonprofit insurers, and you'll have to pick one of them, okay? The question is whether there should be an additional option of a public plan run by the government in addition to all these private options. And mm-hmm. the argument is we need, you know, that the government has to keep these private insurers honest because the government is the low-cost provider because it doesn't have to do all the paperwork and the marketing, and it can use its monopsony power to force prices down so that when it forces prices down, it'll keep these private insurers in line and prevent them from raising costs. But the problem is that the worst thing the private insurers do is not raise costs, it's cherry-pick patients. It's you don't want the guy on dialysis, you want a guy who's healthy, so you offer a health care, you offer a, you know, a gym along with your health care, so you self-select out people who are healthy. So then that's how you make money, is by getting right. healthy patients. And the more the government lowers the cost, it strengthens the imperative to cherry pick. It doesn't keep them honest. It makes them worse than they otherwise would be. So
you mean mandates a lower cost? You mean
no,
the government
suppose the government offers a plan that's pretty cheap, okay? All the mm-hmm. private plans have to meet that price. That means just means they have to cherry pick more if they want to make money. They got to really find healthy patients because the dialysis patient is going to completely bankrupt them. So I don't quite see how the public option helps in that respect. So that's the first thing I noticed from Ruth's article. The second thing is, of course, there are two imperatives. You know, if the private sector starts cherry picking, then the unhealthy patients are all going to end up on the government plan, which is going to raise the government's plan's costs. So it's not clear that the government's going to be the cheapest plan because there's sort of two trains and they're running in the opposite direction. On the one hand, it can bargain down the doctors using its vast buying power and saying, sorry, doc, if you want to, you know, work for the government, you got to take this price. And on the other hand, it can't cherry pick. It's got to take all comers, so it's going to get the sickest patients, so its costs are going to go through the roof. Which of those is going to win? Why won't they actually equilibrate so that the government plan will cost about the same as anything else? All this leads me to think, and this is sort of my thesis, it's idiotic to look at this from the point of view of costs. We don't want a government plan because it'll save costs, because it'll keep anything down. We want the government plan because from the patient's point of view, it's security. It's a safety valve. You know you're not going to get screwed by the private sector. You can always go to the government just the way old people can always go to Medicare, and you'll be taken care of. It's a really right. valuable thing to have, and why aren't they selling it on that basis as opposed to this bogus, slightly bogus, confusing, complicated, wonky, oh, we need it to control costs business?
Wait, maybe I missed something, but is the scenario when you say that the private insurers will have to match the government's costs, that's not like mandated, right? You're just saying that the logic is they will have to do that for competitive purposes.
Yeah, or else they'll have no clients. They'll have no business. Yeah. The argument
right.
is, yeah, they mean if you're selling a car for $50,000 competing against a car for $20,000, people are going to buy the $20,000 car. Same with health insurance. That's
right.
the argument. And the Obama's whole plan, which, I mean, there was an interview with by John Dickerson with Peter Orszag in Slate. He asks Orszag, you know, why should we be for this health care plan? And Orszag says, cost. We can't afford anything else. Well, that's just an insane way to sell the plan. The reason we need health care isn't to save costs. And it's not to provide universal coverage, it's to provide security. Because everybody is worried that their private insurer is going to cut them out when they need it, and they know the government won't do that. Because the government doesn't do that in Medicare.
Well, I agree that you would think that there would be a lot of rhetorical resonance in saying to people, the government is going to provide an absolute, absolute safety net, right?
Exactly.
No matter what happens, you know, I mean, that's so important to people now, you know, because, you know, more and more people are having to work, you know, in this kind of temp status without benefits, and everybody thinks they could lose their job any month. I think that's a killer argument.
Right. And right. They seem to feel that people are going to, I mean, the way it is, the way they structured it now, it's all pain. It's, we'll raise your taxes, and in exchange, we're going to cut your treatments. Isn't that a great deal?
Right.
No, it's not a great deal. It's all pain.
Yeah,
There's a benefit from it that they're hiding. The benefit is you're always going to be taken care of because there's always going to be some government plan there for you that's going to take care of you.
Yeah.
And, because Clinton sold that and lost, remember he had this card and he waved it around before Congress saying, if you have this card, nobody can take your health care away. And he lost. They've decided not to go that route, but that's the obvious route you have to go if you want to sell. Sell the goodie that you're giving people. And for some reason, the whole left has been hornswoggled by Peter Orszag and Ezra Klein into thinking, hey, costs are the important thing.
I knew you had an agenda here somewhere, Mickey, and it's surfaced.
No, I agree with some of the other
things. The old Ezra Klein thing.
I agree with some of the other things Ezra's writing on his blog.
His new Washington Post blog.
That's right. Probably the money they got from firing Frumkin they're using for Ezra.
Yeah. What do you think of that firing of Frumkin, by the way?
Did I read somewhere that we can save that. Did I read he was making $100,000? $100,000?
Frumkin was?
I think that was in the City Paper article. Anyway, that's too much money for Frumkin.
It's too much money for any blogger, as people are slowly realizing. And those bloggers who are grandfathered in should count their lucky stars, should thank their lucky stars.
I was just having this discussion with my editor. Anyway, go ahead. We were talking about Ezra and healthcare.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, okay, so why didn't it work for Clinton? If Clinton made the pitch that you're saying would work, and it didn't work.
Good question.
Thank you. I think I have an answer. I'll give you time to think of it while I give you my answer.
Okay, give you the answer.
I think the lesson of the Clinton healthcare thing is really not so much that you should be willing to compromise once you've got your plan. It's that you shouldn't take so damn long to get the plan together. I mean, do you remember there were these endless task forces, you know, chaired by Ira Magazine or so? It took forever. I mean, the trouble is, the Clintons went into the process with no idea what they wanted. It took forever, and I think this gave the anti-reform lobbyists, you know, the insurance companies, a chance to just get their guns, you know, in order. This is totally theoretical. I know nothing about this.
I don't think it's a hypothesis ready
to be shot down.
My impression during the Hillary debate, and it's a distant memory, is that the middle-of-the-road solutions were actually pretty inadequate. In other words, they weren't anything like the current middle-of-the-road solution, which is an actual exchange of private insurers that will actually cover anybody who wants, you know, with a mandate that they have to take all comers. I mean, it seems to me, I don't think that option was on the table. That wasn't the middle option. So now the debate is in a much better place than it was. And why was it in a bad place then? I don't quite know. I mean, it may be just that, you know, now there's another decade of service in healthcare, and people feel the political imperatives to do something.
But I still say that it would have been good if Obama had had a plan ready out of the gates. And I don't understand why it's so hard. I mean, it seems to me, like back, you know, stimulus package time, if he had said, look, this is part of a stimulus, and you could justify it that way. It makes perfect sense in a time of economic peril. It has some stimulative properties. It has safety net properties. And I think, you know, he could have captured that moment and just sold it. And I don't see why, with all these guys working in think tanks, you know, vying for government jobs, I don't see why you can't say, even before you win the election, you know, tell a few people, look, give me something really detailed, and I'll give you, you know, a nice job in the administration to push it. I don't get it.
Well, I guess the argument is, so Obama comes right out of the box and says, and this is how we're going to fund and we're going to tax, you know, luxury health care benefits, and then that gets shut down, then he's screwed. It's much better if we let Congress come up to that, and then they have to walk the plank. That would be the argument. And there are situations like that, certainly with welfare. You know, the White House didn't put forward a plan. They wanted welfare reform, but they knew that any plan they proposed was going to get shot down and become, they weren't in control of Congress then. I guess that's the difference. But it paid them not to be specific. And sometimes it pays you not to be specific. And there's plenty of time to come up with a plan. I mean, the problem isn't that there's not going to be enough time to come up with a plan. If anything derails it, they're not going to find a politically acceptable way to pay for it. And, you know, I think I agree with Joe Connison on this one. Joe Connison says, you know, $1 trillion over 10 years isn't that much money. And it's not that much money. It's like $100 billion a year. That's just not, in the scheme of things, you know, a huge expenditure. $1 trillion in the course of 1 year, which is the stimulus package, that's a lot of money. But over 10 years, it's a tenth of that. It's not that much money. And if the Democrats can't come up with a way to pay for it, they should find another line of work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so, but that looks like the big obstacle. Anyway, I'm through on health care. I've said my piece. It's all Peter Rozek's fault.
What else can we talk about? I mean, we haven't even entirely exhausted an hour yet.
I know. Well, we could end it and enjoy the sunshine.
That would be precedent setting if we didn't go too long, if we didn't go much longer than anyone wants us to go.
Their ideas falling from the trees onto the ground outside your hotel room right now, and you're missing these ideas by talking to me, and I have no more ideas left. This is usually the time when you talk about reader comments and I fall asleep.
Yeah, okay, so, and you won't let me do that.
I did have an idea of Mark Sanford.
But I got to tell you, wait, can I say one comment-related thing? Or go ahead, what did you want to say?
I think somebody should make a buddy move. Susan Orlean twittered that, hey, John Edwards and Mark Sanford on the road, you know, on the road to Rio would be a good buddy movie. And my line is, it would be a great buddy movie. Hollywood should make it immediately. If you have a sympathetic view of the philandering Paul, and you sort of present it from their point of view and raise issues of, you know, whether marriage is such a great thing and politics and hypocrisy, it could be like Midnight Run meets Madame Bovary. It would be fantastic.
That's an illusion so highbrow that I don't get it.
Midnight Run is this famous movie that is the best B...
That's a drug movie, right, or not?
It's Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin as an FBI agent bringing a mobster to testify and evading the mob. Mm-hmm. And everybody agrees it's the greatest movie ever made, and nobody has seen it except everybody who has video, and everybody in Hollywood just thinks it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Midnight Run. Anyway, go ahead.
I have no comment on that. I'm still, my mind is still reeling at the sophistication of your allusions.
I prepared it ahead of time.
It had that written all over it.
It was originally going to be Midnight Run meets Swingers, but then I thought, that's not funny.
Another movie I haven't seen. But commenters. I encountered some commenters in real life, Mickey.
Really?
On my book tour. You met Uncle Ebenezer when I did. At the
I guess
thing
I did.
We were both at.
I guess I did. Yes,
what
I did.
You guess you did. You know,
but
you
did.
Identify, you were trying to repress it because he said some unflattering things about you.
Did he identify himself as Uncle Ebenezer, or did he use his real name?
Oh, I think he identified himself as Uncle Ebenezer.
Anyway, he seemed like a nice guy. The guy I still haven't met is Connor Friedersdorf.
Oh, I didn't know Connor. Connor has worked for Blogging Heads.
Well, he's a great guy. He blogged on immigration, but I haven't met him.
In a way that you approve. Yes, well, you should, yeah. No, you should.
Anyway.
I think he's back in California. You should get, I think he's back in California.
We should, but go ahead. What were you going to say?
And then the commenter known as Ocean, who you should probably meet, actually. Attractive woman with an exotic foreign accent. You'd like that, wouldn't you?
That sounds like Mark Sanford would like it.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be a scandal in your case. I think, and you know, she might be to your ideological liking a little more than, say, Uncle Ebenezer. I think there's evidence of that. So
it's hard to believe that wouldn't be true, but go ahead. What were you going
to
say?
You want me to work on this? You want me to work on this?
You were just going to offer to fix me up with Ocean?
Yeah.
Well, there's another idea.
I didn't ask her. I can't honestly say that she expressed an interest, but I didn't raise the issue.
Another idea from the Aspen Ideas Festival.
What's that? Yeah. See, they're all over the place. But also, I met Blog and Noggin.
Really?
Yeah.
So Blog and Noggin gets invited to Aspen, and I don't.
No, he's not at Aspen. None of these people are at Aspen. I met him. I gave a book talk at the Harvard University bookstore.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So, what was your best audience so far?
Well, you know what, really, I gotta say, it was a bunch of atheists. I mean, a lot of the audiences were good. The one that you were part of, I thought was good.
I thought you said Caltech was your best audience.
Yes, that was a bunch of atheists. That was Michael Shermer's, you know, skeptics group.
So that would be your winner?
Well, I don't know. You never know. But it was, you know, for some reason, just kind of. You know, they were very responsive to improvisation and, I don't know, they seemed pretty acute. The questions were good. And also, I liked having a little resistance because I have some issues with atheists. I'm getting some atheist blowback.
So they were better than the Harvard audience.
Harvard audience was good. No, they were good.
Okay, very polite.
Harvard in the summer. This is Harvard in the summer we're talking about.
Oh, you know, I thought it was
not
just
fair to judge any university in the summer, but they were good.
Okay, I thought it was just now. Okay. We're almost at an hour, so can we let our listeners go?
We can, but I want to say, I want to say one thing, though. You know, listeners who are on Facebook should feel free to sign up to the official Evolution of God, like, page or whatever. It's like a fan page. And for that matter, they should feel free to friend me. But if they're going to do that, they need to identify themselves as Blogging Heads viewers and say something that lets me know that it's true, you know, because if they just say they're Blogging Heads viewers, then for all I know, they're really terrorists, like it's Osama bin Laden or somebody. You know, they've got to
well,
say
so
something that only a real viewer would know. What?
What difference does it make?
Well, if you read my book, you've got a virtual recipe to use in the war on terror, and I don't want the terrorists to get a hold of that. They could subvert the whole thing.
But can't the terrorists buy your book in a bookstore?
Mickey, I think the less we talk about that, the better, okay?
Yeah, I actually have...
Let's give them the idea.
I have one more topic, which is, have you noticed the eerie resonance between your talking about... it's in our interest to align ourselves with the moral axis of the universe, and Martin Luther King saying that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
Although I gotta say, the first parallel between that line, his line, and my own work was drawn by no less than Bill Clinton, who summarized Non-Zero by quoting Martin Luther King.
Well, I would think that's fine. So
right.
Maybe that's where
I got the idea.
Are they actually different, or is it a fake? Is it a fake meretricious?
I'm not even sure it's the moral arc. I thought it was the arc of history is long, but it leads toward justice. But it bends toward justice.
According to the quote from Leon, it's the arc of the moral universe. That's in quotes in Leon's column. So there.
But you know what? You know what though? I think he's quoting Obama's impromptu paraphrasal, and I actually think it may not be right.
That's entirely possible.
I think he's quoting Obama there, and I think
I think you are slightly saying two different things, but
Oh, bring it on, bring it on.
No, I don't know for sure.
What are the two different things King, I'm saying?
King is saying the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. It's sort of like the mills of the gods take a long time, but they grind fine.
Right. Oh, they are different.
And,
yeah, the moral...
You're saying it's in the interest of humanity, it's in humanity's self-interest to align yourself with what is the moral warp and woof of the universe, as opposed to perverts like me who say it's humanity's job to stand aside the warp and woof of the universe and yell stop.
Sometimes you want to yell stop. But I agree, it's actually not, the language may sound the same, it's actually not the same thing. The moral axis of the universe is different from, well, it's different from the argument in Non-Zero that Clinton was summarizing by reference to King, and it's different to what King was saying.
Yeah.
But, you know, in closing, can I ask people to not accept any characterization of this last book as accurate?
I think they should go buy it and read it themselves.
Yeah, because it's really getting bad. I mean, I think it's Nicholas Wade wrote this blog item in the New York Times that he didn't in his defense, he didn't claim to have read the book. But
which book is it? Evolution of God or Non-Zero?
The Evolution of God. I mean, it was pathetic. It was pathetically misrepresentative.
Huh. Interesting. Can we put up a link to this misrepresenting link?
Yeah.
Misrepresenting blog item? I can say, people should read the book because it's actually fun. It's reading the book is more fun than reading the summaries of the book. You have a lot of fun with the various stupid names of the gods and the theories of why they did this and this. You have a Malcolm Gladwell-like enjoyment of your subject, and the evolution of God is in the detail.
That's great. But, you know, it's true. This is the price you pay for making arguments in a book, is that the reviews focus on the arguments. So even if it has a narrative structure, they don't bother to comment on how that works out, you know?
Yeah. It's a fun read. I mean, I've only read 90% of it. I haven't gotten to you wrestling with the divinity at the end.
Nah, skip it.
But it was a rewarding and fun read.
It's nice of you to say that.
So there.
Even if you believe it, it's nice of you to say.
I do believe.
Well, God, I can't think of a better note to end on, personally.
I can't either.
Except, happy birthday to Couch Files, Mickey. You know, you were blogging before it was blogging, so you had not heard the word blog, according to your... We should also link to your little retrospective.
Well, it was just an excuse to try to get some publicity.
Right, but you said that you had not heard the word blog when you started your blog.
Well, that's true, but the word blog had been invented. Other people were using it. I just didn't know that that's what I was doing.
Now, and how long had AndrewSullivan.com been around?
Oh, no.
It had. You were before Andrew Sullivan? Because I remember when I got his email announcing his site, and it was named AndrewSullivan.com, I thought, whoa, you just name something after yourself? And now that's commonplace. So I thought that
was like... House Files is a terrible name, but I know nobody's going to steal it. So
no. Remember why I talked you out of Floater.com, which is another thing you were thinking about.
That was a good name. Why did you talk me out of that?
Well, there were two issues. One was that it's a term for a dead body floating in a river. The other is something I don't really want to bring up.
Totally appropriate.
And but the other one, you knew about that connotation. But when I mentioned this other thing, I said, "This is what it reminds me of." You went, "Oh no, now I can't." Now that that's in my head, I thought
I didn't do it because I couldn't get it. It was taken by somebody. Anyway.
No, I think it was the turd thing.
That's not a note to end on, Bob. Jesus.
That's what?
You just totally destroyed the atmosphere. But anyway, it's Andrew Sullivan, Instapundit, Josh Marshall all came after me, and I could see them, like they were saying, I'm thinking of starting a blog, and I thought, oh, well, sure, you Johnny come lately. And then they all zoomed past me into the stratosphere, and now, of course, they're much, 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 much bigger than I am, so I have to resort to cheap tricks.
But maybe
like
that's because you stuck by your standards.
To get some attention. Sorry?
Do you think that's because you stuck by your standards, you stuck by your ideals, the way you want Obama to do with foreign policy?
No, I think it's because they have more energy than I do. Certainly,
I don't know.
Certainly,
I mean, they may.
Certainly, all three of those people approach it in a more disciplined and energetic way than I do. But
it's
so
not just energy. There's a lot of things. I think. Well, you do some opportunistic strategic linking, but you're not governed by that at all. I think our hats should be off to you.
They each have a competitive advantage that I don't have. Instapundit is a Catholic sort of faculty brat who knows a lot about a lot, and so he can link, you know, to a whole wide range of things and comment, and he has an ideology. He knows what he thinks. He knows what he has to say. I'm sort of all, oh, what do I think? So it takes me forever. Andrew is very disciplined, and he has this British quality as he can bloviate about anything on a moment's notice. So every morning he gets up and he bloviates about six topics, and it's done. He has the good hack quality of getting it done. You can't trust anything he said, but he gets it done. And Josh Marshall just has a lot of energy generally. So those three people, you know, and also Josh Marshall is firmly on the left, and he gets, you know, his left legs. So there. And I'm in the center, and the center doesn't get any. No, but the center is not a way to attract links on the web.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with any of your characterizations of those people, but you're the blogging expert.
What do you disagree with?
Well, for one thing, I mean, Instapundit. Well, I mean, here's the thing about Instapundit. I think he carries the kind of, you know, traffic generating strategy to such a sophisticated level, kind of, that he's a disc jockey more than a musician in a way. I mean, I've said this to him on Blogging Heads that he maximizes, his formula maximizes the number of obligations to reciprocally link that you incur.
But that's not why he's big. He's big because he links to everybody and he's your gateway to the web. And if you want to find out what's going on,
well, that
on the web
too.
Today,
okay,
you go
no, ahead. It has other virtues. He meshes this with other virtues, like he has so many items that you know there's always something new there, so you can get addicted to the site.
Right.
But
well,
that happily coincides with incurring a ton of obligations to reciprocally link.
Well, sure, but
it's a perfect formula. It's brilliant.
But he's big not because of the obligations. He's big because he got big very, very quickly because he was your gateway to the blogosphere, at least.
Yeah, well, I didn't follow it to see. I don't know how the chicken and egg thing worked out, but I think now it does not hurt him that a lot of people link. As you know, you have to constantly replenish your traffic with horizontal links. You know, if you just build a following, you know, attrition will ultimately erode it unless you've got fresh traffic coming in.
I didn't
know
that.
We were on the verge of not going too long. Do you remember?
That's a good tip, I know. But now we've gone too long. I hope you're happy.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. What was it my fault? Okay, it was.
We just have to get rid of that bad image you left us with a few minutes ago.
Floater.
So, God, Bob, you have a sick sense of humor. Okay. But you're brilliant.
It's so nice of you to say that. Well, I got to get back to hobnobbing with all the brilliant people here and soak up the ideas.
Okay. Bring a lot of ideas home. Okay.
Okay. See you around.
See ya. Bye.